So I'm going to put the picture up in just a few minutes, but first I want to double check and see if anyone is new here for the first time. I realized that I was only looking at the 9 or 12 squares here, and I didn't really look and see that there's more. So I'm just going to double check and see if there's anybody who is new. Hi, Meredith. Good thing I asked, isn't it? it's good to see you. Tonight, we are going to talk about what are called the ox herding stories. We're on the last two. We are on picture 9. There are 10 of them. So we're going to talk about those. And I'm trying to see if I can get this hold on a second. Where is the... Do you know how to stop the... transcription? Yeah, just the CC. So once it's on for everybody. It's okay. I can tolerate it. I'm fine. Oh yeah, if you hit CC there on your screen, see where, yeah, you just hit that, it should go away for yours. I don't know if it'll go away for mine. But anyway, Meredith, we are doing the ox herding tales, and we're on picture 9. So I'll put the picture up a little bit later, but I'm just going to give a little bit of background about it. We're in a kind of, I mean, on one hand, you can look at this as a kind of esoteric place or stage in practice. And if you're not familiar with the 10 ox herding stories, they are 10 stories. They're Zen, 10 pictures with a verse. They're stories. They're 10 separate stages in practice. And they are designed to help us see how practice itself progresses along the path. So we are towards the end here, towards enlightenment, I guess, what you could think of it as. But we'll talk a little bit about that. And then what we do is each month we take the picture and we talk about it as much as we need to talk about it for the whole month. And then and then next month we will do the last picture. So we do a talk tonight, and then next week, if you come back, we're going to do a little discussion. We'll have a recap of the talk, and then we'll have a little discussion with each other in breakout rooms and things like that. But tonight, we're just going to have a little talk and take some questions, comments about it. So when I was at the retreat, I was at Spirit Rock doing the Fall Insight Retreat, and while I was there, I thought about this picture that I was going to come and talk about. And it just so happened, one of the Dhamma talks that I offered, the story I used is the story I want to share now about this picture. Because I think sometimes that if we make this stage of practice so far beyond our reach, then it takes our practice out of the possibility for a spiritual awakening and puts our practice into some kind of self-help. I'm going to, you know, work my way through. That these later pictures are really designed to help us see the spiritual awakening that's possible in practice, beyond anything our ordinary mind can comprehend. And so the story I want to share, I've told it before, but I don't know if anyone here has ever heard it. But anyway, it was a time before I ever started practicing. I have two kids, two boys. My youngest was in a pouch. He was an infant. And the oldest was, I think he probably was about 6 years old. And somehow in my life, I had ended up in a shelter in downtown Seattle. And it was an emergency shelter. And I know the circumstances of how I ended up in the shelter, but I don't have any, sadness around this story or this moment I'm going to share. I can't feel any kind of disappointment or sadness or, you know, I know the details of how I ended up in a shelter, but I don't feel any particular pain around it. In fact, the only thing I ever think of when I think about that time I was in the shelter and I was there for about two, maybe 3 months is this story right here that I'm about to show. That's the only thing I actually think about. It's the thing that stuck with me, and that in sticking with me, I think it ultimately led to my finding my way to the Dhamma years later. But this was sort of like one of those moments back in the very beginning picture when we first were looking at the maybe the glimpses. And yet I feel as though I'm returning back to that same moment in time. Anyway, so this moment is that the shelter was right above a coffee shop, and I used to have to catch the bus to take my youngest, the baby, to the daycare or the lady that was keeping him. And then I would catch another bus to take Raymond, the oldest, to school, and then another bus to go to work. And then I would catch that bus and go pick up Raymond, and then Raymond and I, we'd go pick up Thaddeus, and then we'd catch the bus to go back to the shelter. So, I mean, just think about it. I'm living in a shelter. I'm catching 3 buses every day, and yet I do not have any negative relationship. It's actually quite a sweet time. So every morning, my youngest boy would get up and he would be in a tizzy to make sure we got ready so we could get coffee, because we needed to get coffee. And he would ask me all morning, are we going to get coffee? Are we going to get coffee? Are we going to get coffee? And I would have to convince him that we will not get coffee unless he gets dressed. So he would make sure that he got dressed and Thaddeus got dressed and I would get myself ready for work. He was so cute. I can remember him, the excitement, the joy, and his running down the hall, or more like skipping, almost falling down the hall to get to the shared bathroom in order to get ready for school. And then we would get ready, we'd get out there, we'd go to this coffee shop. And why this barista put Raymond's chocolate milk in a coffee cup, I will never know. But he did. He put Raymond's milk in a coffee cup. So he had no coffee. It wasn't even hot. But he would get his coffee and I would get mine. And we would sit out at this bus stop and wait for the bus. And I can remember with pristine clarity the sound outside. So we left very early. And I would sit there at this bus stop. There'd be no cars, hardly no people. Every once in a while, a car would pass by. The weather didn't seem to be particularly bad. And we would sit at this bus stop. And Raymond would ask me questions about politics and what did I think about a good job for him and what kind of work he thinks he would like to do and what did I think about the president and did I think working was something that people should really do? Is it like school? And every once in a while, he would blow on his coffee. And I could hear him blowing on his coffee every once in a while, just kind of like that sound of traffic going by and Raymond and I sitting there talking about politics. It seemed as though the whole world was right. And I don't have a sense of complaint about the time at all. It was, whatever it was still. And it wasn't until I started going on retreats that I actually began to visualize what had happened back then and the level of tranquility and stillness that existed in the moment. That's what is the most pronounced part of that whole period of 2 or 3 months when I would catch the bus. That's what I remember, is the tranquility, the stillness that existed between Raymond and I. Thaddeus was perfectly happy stuffed down in the pouch. He didn't really need any tending to. And so it would be Raymond and I sitting there riding the bus, talking in a way that I don't think we've ever really talked except for right then, with such clarity. So here we had this pristine stillness around the whole process. And there was all this potentiality for negativity that happens around, because you don't end up in an emergency shelter unless you got some difficulties going on. And the beauty of the whole thing, all of that, was all moving at the same time. And I think this picture 9 is talking about that. So I had experienced this picture at a time when I wasn't even connected to the Dhamma. That's why I think it's important for us to not have these pictures too far away from reality. And the only thing that actually happened that I can think of about that picture, I mean, about that time, is that I have such a visceral memory of being in that moment, almost like deja vu. You know, when you have a deja vu moment where it almost seems like I'm living it out as it's happening. That's what I feel. Whenever I think back to that time, I feel almost here. I can feel sitting on the bus stop and having Raymond sitting right here. I can feel it. Seems real. And it seems that is what was real. Everything else about that time, I can tell you what happened, but none of it seems real. Seems almost dreamlike, like I'm telling you a story. But that was real. And this is what I think this picture is pointing to. That last month in picture 8, when there was just the circle, we were investigating our perception. Can we perceive that everything is as it is, that both the good and the bad walk simultaneously, that there's no separation like our mind likes to do and separate things out? So in a way, the mind can separate out that time and just pick something good or bad. But it doesn't have to. There's no separation on that in the story I told you. It feels all, I know it all of it. But when we can begin to open, practice is what actually helps us open that understanding. Because we could sit here as individuals in our ordinary mind, and we could try to think, oh, yeah, there's not really any good or bad. Everything is even. You are not going to believe that. Because in our minds, the ordinary mind will be like, yeah, okay, what about those, you know, other political people? What about them? What about the people that we think are just flat out crazy? What about those people? And surely there's got to be a right way to do things. I mean, surely there's got to, surely racism and sexism and all of the isms, surely that's wrong. I mean, immediately the mind will begin to pick out things that are wrong. Homelessness, wrong. Oppression, harm, wrong. So surely the mind can't just accept this notion of everything is together. There's no duality, that beauty and ugliness walk hand in hand or accompany each other, that they belong together. Right, wrong belongs together. Wisdom and folly belong together and they exist together. So to try to make our minds accept this is the wrong way that practice is pointing to. What I think practice is pointing to is that gradually over the process of the pictures 1 through 7, we begin to come to an understanding. And in that understanding, it's like me sitting on the bus stop, on that bench in the bus stop. There's an understanding of all of it being as it is. It's just the way it is. And so because I don't have any judgment about that time, because there was enough tranquility and stillness around the whole thing, and I didn't have any resistance to it one way or the other, I can perceive the entire event as a beautiful thing. I can perceive the entire event. Even the fact that I'm telling you I was in a shelter, I can perceive it as a beautiful thing. You can hear it as a beautiful thing. I could tell you that exact same story from a completely different perspective, and we would all feel the pain of it. I could tell it from anger. We would feel the frustration of it. I could tell it from some kind of, inspirational kind of, I've made my way through and I somehow solved it. And we would all feel that. But what stuck out was the tranquility, the stillness, the moment that held it all together. And so that time feels very still to me, very peaceful, feels very calm, and nothing dramatic about it at all. So we're going to put this picture up and I'm going to show you what it is that I'm trying to talk to in this picture here. So the picture itself is just leaves, like if there's no path here, there's no ox or bull here, there's no practitioner. What you're really looking at is just nature. That's it. This is just a representation, I think, of the way things are. So we don't know if that tree is a good tree or a bad tree. We don't know if it's a sick tree or a healthy tree. We don't know anything about it. It's just a tree. It's just greenery. It just represents nature itself. That's all it represents, this kind of relationship, because it is just the nature of things. It is just the truth of things. And this is what I think returning to the origin or back to the source, what we're actually doing is going back to the truth of our own ability to just be with anything. There is nothing in life that we cannot be with. I don't care how uglier, how much we don't want it to be that way, or how much we want it to be like this. What this picture is really pointing to is that we have the body and the mind to be with anything and everything. And that the only thing that really gets in the way is what we've been doing in our practice in pictures 1 through 7, really beginning to see how much we push against reality. And the more we push against reality, the less we have the capacity to be with it. But if we don't push against reality, then whatever arises, we have the capacity to be with it. And when I say be with it, I mean the capacity to respond. I mean, I didn't live in a shelter for a long, long time. I did figure out a way to get out of a shelter. I did have to do things while I was in the shelter, things that I know I had to do. So there are ways that we have to respond to the conditions that are in front of us. But the resistance to those conditions is the problem that practice is pointing to. So if we look at this verse, before we talk about the verse, there's a couple of things I want to note here. I was telling the Thursday night group, I pointed it out to them, and I want to point it out to us. In this first part, where it says, better to have been blind and deaf. I'm going to talk about what that means, and we can't really change the languaging. This is just the way it is. But it really is, this is really unskillful speech. We don't, it's a kind of a slight to ableism is what it is. It's somehow implying that if you're blind or you're deaf, that is the problem. I know and I understand what it's pointing to, and I've made this mistake myself, that I just want to point it out that we don't have to use blindness and deafness as a sign of ignorance or problematic. We could have said confusion or unaware. So it's better to be unaware and confused than to be what the verse is pointing to. It would be just as respectful to just say unaware or confused. You don't necessarily have to say or ignorance. You know, ignorance is bliss, basically. You could have said that. But anyways, the first part of the picture is too many steps have been taken returning to the root and the source. Better to have been blind and deaf. And what that's really pointing to me, or blind and deaf from the beginning, is that phrase, ignorance is bliss. Like, it's pointing that by the time we get to this point in practice, we have practiced a long time. We have done a lot of work. We have seen a lot of harm, and we have felt a lot of suffering. And at this point in our practice, we are not, we are accustomed to suffering. We are accustomed to the hindrances. We are accustomed to the first noble truth and the second noble truth of suffering and the causes of suffering. So here we are not newbies, and we are not shy about it. So even though I'm using a time when I was not even a practitioner, the reason for using that story is because I didn't know what was at hand when I was sitting there. If I had the wisdom that I have now, then I would have saved myself a whole bunch of suffering. But I assure you that over the next 25 years, I did a lot of suffering because I didn't have the wisdom of mind, even though the possibility of awakening is very much real. Do you see what I'm pointing to? It's very real. It's not some, we're not transcending into non-worldly beings. So I gotta be some kind of special something. You're gonna be the same person you are, but your capacity to not push against reality is what changes. And so if you were to ask my relatives and friends, is Tori the same person? They will say, yes, she is. She's the same person she always was. I get angry just like I used to. Everything is pretty much the same. But everybody in the world doesn't have to pay for my anger. And I don't have to hold on to anger for days on end. So basically what this picture is pointing to and what the verse is pointing to is that we work hard over the course of practice, and there is a place that we're going to get to. And that's the second half. So even though too many steps have been taken, returning to the root and the source, better to have been blind and deaf from the beginning. Better to just stay ignorant and unaware. But dwelling in one's true abode, unconcerned with and without, the river flows tranquilly on and the flowers are red. So that to me is what happened to me when I was sitting on the bench, that whole process. The flower was red, which is, the truth is, I ended up in a shelter and had to take buses to get to work, and we did it. But at the same time, it was such a peaceful time, such a tranquil time. And I was just dwelling in the truth of the way my life was at that time. I didn't push against anything. I didn't complain about anything. I remember having a degree of gratitude that I wasn't out in the street somewhere. So there's this gratitude, and there was a sense of having fun. Me and the boys, it was just the three of us. And so there was a sense of just being with the flow of life, and with it, I was also very much peaceful. This is what I think the Buddha is pointing to. He's not pointing to somehow or another we're going to transcend any problems and everything's going to be perfect and we're just going to float through life. That is an ordinary mind thinking. What the Buddha's pointing to is that even if the economy came crashing in on us tomorrow, our capacity to be with the whole thing is completely doable. And not just doable because we grin and bear it, but doable in tranquility. Because the stillness of the moment is a non-resisting stillness. It's not because everything is okay. It's just that we are not resisting to it. The second thing I want to kind of point to here, we can take the picture down, is that the reason why this path to get to picture 9 is so difficult and arduous, and it takes us a while to get there, has nothing to do with your own mental capacity to access enlightenment. You could access enlightenment right now. Any one of us could. I had access to it right there on the bench. But we live in a culture, and it's partly samsara, this ending cyclical nature of ignorance and suffering, birth, aging, and death, and this constant trying to make things better, this constant need to have things true and wise and right and beautiful and all on the pleasing side and never on the ugly side. We don't want that. We want the pleasing side. That right there sets us up. It throws enlightenment across the oceans. And then we got to walk the miles and miles and miles to go find it. But when we just accept the true reality of the moment, whatever it is, now enlightenment right here. This is what I was pointing to in Ryokan's response to his teacher. See, at one point, there was, in the first half of the poem, nothing in the world, whether gold or silver or pair of pearls, can be more of worth than this long promised visit from you early in the spring. There's a sense there where it will be better when you get here. And so, of course, you can feel the suffering in him, the sense of, it's not, it doesn't have to be bad, but you can feel the longing for something that's not here. In the divine law, there is nothing to stop you doing what you like, so long as you do all things knowing them all as they are. And in this, the second part of this, there is a sense of acceptance is what I heard in it. And so that's why I read it, is that there's a way in which we are learning how to accept life on life's terms. Somebody at the retreat asked about karma. And Eugene gave this, probably one of the few answers I've ever heard on karma that was just a short answer, but it touched on the truth of karma, that we have to remind ourselves about this often. Because this idea of separating the world into the good and the bad and the right and the wrong and the beauty and the not, all of that separation creates in our mind some way that our karma or our actions, this karma, we could control the beauty, the right, the wrong. We can control the upside of our life. That's what it implies. Work hard, be good. We can control this upside. But Eugene was sharing that, it's Eugene Cash, he was sharing that karma is not just your actions, but it's the intersection with your actions and my actions. It's the intersection of your actions, my actions, and political leaders' actions. Your actions, my actions, and somebody else down the way. Your actions, my actions, and societal actions, where we happen to be in society right now. It's your actions, my actions, and the human evolution. So you're, what really he was saying was, there is so many implications as to how a moment happens. Your actions, my actions, your great, 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 great grandparents' actions may have some influence on the genes you have in your body right now. And they just lay in dormant till you get 82. And then, boom, they show up. And you're like, why? You're 82. It kicked in. The point that this picture is pointing to is that when we actually begin to let go of the notion of control, which is what I think pictures 1 through 7 are all about, are trying to control everything. But probably pictures 1 through 6 is the trying to control everything. Picture 7, we're actually beginning to let some of that control go. Picture 8, we can see that we're letting go of both ourselves, our path. We're letting go of everything. And then picture 9 is this living out in this new perception, this new way of understanding. That our task is not to figure out how to live the best life, but our task is really to just live with whatever life is. Live with it. It's a hard thing, this practice that we're doing. There's no doubt about that. It's hard. But it is not abstract. It is not so foreign that you have to have a certain kind of world in order to be in it. So any person in this hall or this meeting hall, any person on this Zoom, any person that listens to the talk online 2 years from now, any one of us has access to the awakened mind. It's already here. It's just clouded over by a lot of confusion and a lot of fear. And our practice is really trying to chip away and cut away at that armor. Just a little bit at a time, chipping away. There's no harm in even the fact that we have the armor and the can't see, and there's no harm in any of it. It's just a gradual process that we're doing. All right, let me just leave you with one last ryokan. Flowers are silent when asked about their where from of spring revival. Yet, when they bloom in the sun, no songbirds will stay behind. I'll let this think on that. Thank you so much for your kind attention. So, let's see if we have any comments or questions or anything like that. Yeah, Deb. Do you mind coming up here?
really need to work on these things.
We're all well trained in this hall to assume the seat when we ask
questions. That's right. We are well trained.
I wanted to ask you again about, you raised the point earlier in the talk about the isms, you know, racism. And and I kind of forgot or didn't follow your line of teaching about that. And I wonder if you could sum that up again, because being, you know, coming to stillness in the midst of it all and maintaining my equilibrium in the midst of it all, you know, standing in the middle, is always something I'm striving for. And I think I attain it once in a while. But certainly what rocks me over is when I see what I think are wrongs, such as racism, to name one. And how, so can you please sum up again what you were saying about how do I remain, how do I attain stillness? How do I wait for stillness? So what is the relationship with stillness and these terrible wrongs in our society?
See, the stillness is already there. I guess what I think what the practice is pointing to, these are so difficult to talk about this. Let's see if I can talk about it. So I got to use ordinary language, ordinary mind to talk about a liberative quality. That's why this is so difficult. But racism and all of the isms in the world are greed, hatred, and delusion. It is the nature of greed, hatred, and delusion. And greed, hatred, and delusion of racism or homophobia, all of it, is no different than the greed, hatred, and delusion you have when you don't like peace or you don't like, you don't like your neighbor. They make too much noise, you know? It's all the same. It's the ordinary mind that somehow says that that not liking my neighbor making too much noise because they're bad, they're wrong, they're making too much noise, is somehow minor compared to racism. These kinds of distinction that the mind makes is what keeps us trapped in the world we're in. And we are in a world where there is a lot of greed, hatred, and delusion. So greed, hatred, and delusion leads to suffering. Big greed, hatred, and delusion leads to big suffering. So yes, racism is going to lead to suffering. There is no ins and out about it. What I think the stillness comes from is this notion that instead of trying to simply respond and deal with the suffering that's caused by greed, hatred, and delusion, we try to somehow or another right the wrong of it. And the righting the wrong of it is the problem. So if I'm speaking as a Black woman, I do not know a time when we have not liked Black people. I don't really know a time. I love history, and I've been looking at a lot of history. So I don't know a time when there was somehow or another, there was no discrimination towards Black people. I don't know a time when there was no discrimination towards women. I don't know a time when there was no discrimination against gay people. I don't know. There's always going to be a time when we are going to discriminate and harm other people as long as the defilement of greed, hatred, and delusion exists. It will always be there. So from the Dhamma's perspective, we are not, this is what I think of what the Dhamma is pointing to. We are not trying to end racism, sexism, homophobia, all of that. We are trying to have the courage to stand up to the harm caused by it. And if we made it more about dealing with the harm that's caused by these isms, then it has a different effect. We're not in the business of creating solutions or results. We're in the business of practicing with the present moment's harm. And that's what I think the practice is designed for. You will never be able to answer that question, how do I deal with all these wrongs? Because by the very nature of the question, you will never deal with all the wrongs. They will always be here. But if you say, how do I deal with the harm to trans people? Well, then we stand up for people that are trans. We do what we need to do to respond to that harm. And we just do that. But to try to end to try to make people not hate trans people, I don't know how you're going to do that. I don't know how anybody, I think we're just going to keep fighting with each other for it. But if the general public responded to the harm to trans people as a public societal thing, then I think people who would harm trans people would keep that in check because they would know that there would be a consequence to it. But right now, we get so caught up in the wishing the wrong was not that and resisting that, that we don't ultimately do anything about it. That's what I think the difficulty is with right and wrong. Because right and wrong can keep us so locked in the thinking about it, but not very active. So Kuan Yin, the practice of compassion, is different than metta. Karuna is different from metta. Karuna is this universal friendliness, kindness, care towards all beings. But compassion is a direct responding to suffering. That's what it is. And so oftentimes when people say, I have compassion fatigue, I'm sort of like, how can you have compassion fatigue? Doesn't work. Because the compassion is energized to respond to harm. So if you have compassion fatigue, it means you're thinking about the harm way too much, but not actually responding to it. You may have fatigue because I've been responding so much, but that is not compassion fatigue. That is just, I'm tired and I've done a lot of activism and I need to take a break for my own sense of you know, self-care. But that's fatigue. And as humans, we all have fatigue. It's the compassion fatigue that doesn't make any sense to me, because compassion needs suffering and it needs the suffering to respond to. So I hope I have, it's sort of like when I write my little blog post for the Capitol Hill group, I try to say it in a succinct way, but it usually ends up being long on some of these because it's very difficult to talk about an ordinary understanding. We all have an ordinary understanding that this is right and this is wrong. So no one's going to sit here and say, oh, then are you saying racism is right? It's not, are you saying it's not wrong? It's not a right or a wrong. It is greed, hatred, and delusion. And greed, hatred, and delusion causes suffering. We all do it. We all create that suffering in the world. And so our task as practitioners is to get comfortable enough with suffering that we will respond to it and not turn away. Because the Buddha's, what got him on the path was because he kept turning away from things he knew to be true. So he knew death was coming, and he knew illness was coming, and he knew old age was coming. And yet, whenever he would see someone who was ill or dying or anything like that, he would turn away. And he kept asking himself, why do I turn away from that which is true? So that's the question. It isn't. If you can't, let's say we're kind of glorifying harm in a way in the world. And so we see all these videos of people getting harmed by racism and things like that. And if you just look at it, the video, and you don't respond, then you're just going to be mad. So the response may be, you may not know the person. You don't even know. That video could have been 2 years ago, and now it's just now showing up on your feed. The whole thing is over with. Or you don't even know where this happened. Nobody says a city or anything. Then your response has to be metta. It has to be, you have to respond in some way. You have to send metta to the people. You have to carry that, like the release, or the, you have to move your energy, even if the movement of energy is just the sending of metta and the wishing that whatever harm happened is cared for, something like that. That's about the best you can do on some of these random videos or random things that we hear about. We are in a global world. So I think in Buddha's time, people heard more about what was happening with people they knew. And now we hear about things about people in faraway places that we will never visit, never have any connection to. And so we have to send our energetic care there is the best way we can do it. So that's what I think. That's what I think. So what I would do, Deb, if I were you, is I would question one other thing I want to say. It's not the world has to be still. That stillness already exists. Meaning that when I was sitting on that bench, I could have easily dwelled in all the drama that was going on in my life, because there was drama going on. I don't know how. I mean, I understand now as a practitioner. I did not understand then how I tapped into the tranquility of the whole thing. So this tranquility is already there because it holds everything. The tranquility is no pushing against the reality of what is arising in this moment. And I didn't push against it. And that in and of itself, that pushing, that resisting, that trying to fix it and make it what you think it should be, that is where the difficulty is. But when we're with it as it is, painful as it is, I'm going to send some metta here because I cannot do anything else. That is where the stillness lies. So that's what I would look at, is how much are you just knowing the pain of the world and stuck in the right wrongness of it? That's going to keep you up in all that movement. And how much can you drop down in the accepting that this is the nature of the way it is? And what can you do then to respond? And really, I think the more we actually start feeling that pain and responding, the more courage we'll have. It really boils down to courage. And that courage only comes when we are no longer afraid to feel the suffering. And as long as we're afraid to feel it, we are not going to have the courage to do anything about it. We just are going to get stuck in this is right and this is wrong. Does that make sense? That's what I think I think as practitioners, this whole kind of, I know I'm kind of going on and on, but I can't help it. It takes a lot of words to talk about this. Last thing, this idea that wokeness is just some kind of a bad thing. This anti-wokeness is a little problematic to me, but there is one part of it that I understand. There is nothing worse than a person who has the judgment that they are woke, the self-righteousness that I have transcended and you are the problem. There's nothing worse than that. And that's what I think we cannot be. If we're going to be awake, then we are going to have to respond to the pain of the world. That's what true awakeness is. We're going to have to be with it. And so that's what it doesn't do us any good to be woke just because we can tell everybody that we are. I'm awake. That's like some student sent me an email one day and said, Tuari, I don't need you anymore. I am enlightened. It happened at 3:33 on Wednesday. And so I don't think I need to check in with you anymore. And I wrote back and I said, oh, that's great. Good for you. Okay. Well, I'll just take you off the schedule. Thank God. But that's what it is. It's sort of this, you can't just walk around and proclaim we're awake. And yet we don't want to feel any suffering. All right. So that, I'm hoping that every answer would not be that long. Oh, I do see a hand up there. Laura, what you got?
Hi.
Laurie, sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I'm curious about. Oh, it's so weird. I hear myself.
I know, that's what I was doing.
So we are tranquil so that we can feel the suffering, and how do we know when and how we skillfully respond to the suffering? Because it's easy to see as like, okay, I feel the suffering. I'm sending metta, and that's all I need to or can do, right? That doesn't always work. So how do we think about skillful responses?
again, we are, I got to make a distinction between ordinary mind and wisdom mind. I don't know if you can hear it, but I can hear it in the way you're asking the question. The ordinary mind has already judged metta as being insignificant. We need to be out there doing something. So a better way to hold this is, in the moment that you're actually feeling the suffering, that moment will tell you what you can and cannot do. I remember going to a retreat right during the middle of the Iraq War, the first one, and Bush's War, Sun Bush's War. And I remember feeling so overwhelmed by it. The retreat was shortly after it had started. And everybody in the retreat was at Cloud Mountain with some nuns. And somebody asked the nuns, you know, like, what should we do? What should we do about this war? And we got to do something to make it stop. And she goes, send metta. And we were like, send metta? No, we got to do something to make this stop. That's what we got to do. She said, send metta, send metta, send metta. It did not make any sense to me what she was saying. But every day we practiced metta for the Iraqi people and all the soldiers. And we just kept sending metta. By the end of that retreat, I felt settled around this Iraq war, settled into the acceptance of it. And then I talked to my friend and we found out about all these protests that were happening all over the world. I mean, all over the country. And I spent the next 3 years traveling all over the country to these gigantic Stop the War protests that most of the country, if you didn't go to that protest, you didn't even know they were happening. And my mother would say, I know you went to Chicago for a protest. I'm sorry that it didn't happen. And I'm like, there was like 500,000 people there. But it just never got on the news. And so I felt throughout that war, I felt so open and I felt like I was doing something and I felt connected to so many people. And I was not stuck in grumbling about the war. And yet a lot of my friends were grumbling about the war because their efforts, or it seemed like there was nothing to be done. That's the ordinary mind. It will make the suffering so much larger than you can do. And metta seems like it's nothing. You're not doing the metta to solve the problem. You're doing the metta to get you close to that suffering so you will know in the moment how to be with it and not get stuck in your fear about the suffering. Do you see what the metta is not? That's what the nuns were trying to tell us. The metta is not to solve the Iraqi war. The metta is to get you to soften and get close to that suffering. And then you will know what to do, what you can do. And I spent a boatload of money. And for me, traveling all over the country to all these protests was almost like a godsend, because I felt like I was not just doing nothing, complaining about being in a war. I felt like I was making my voice heard. I was actively involved in it. And so every few months they would have some protest somewhere and my friend and I would show up. We'd be there. It was fantastic. The whole thing was fantastic. So did that end the Iraq war? No. But I don't know, because I don't know. because there was clearly the politicians knew about the level of protests that were going on. And yet the media didn't really cover it like that, but they knew how big these protests were. They knew, I knew. And so I don't know any other way to say it other than that way. I think that don't poo-poo metta and compassion, these Brahmaviharas. They are not designed to solve problems. So no, I'm not throwing a little metta on the problem and that's the best I can do. They are strengthening our resolve to be able to stay with the difficulty until we know exactly what to do. But you have to be able to stay with that difficulty and not shrink away from it and wish it would all just go away. So that's what the metta is for, is to soften you up so that you can stay with the difficulty. Iris, let me turn my thing off.
I've sort of raised my hand and put it down about five times. I think that I understand what you're saying, Tiwari. And then sometimes I think, well, wait a second. It sounds like a contradiction. So, and integrating the wisdom mind and the ordinary mind. But we know we have to face the suffering. We have to be moved by the reality of what's going on. And we respond as appropriately as we can. And sometimes that response is action, 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 as you just told about your action. If we think about the civil rights movement and what people did in the 60s and the 70s, you know, there was a whole lot of consciousness and there was a whole lot of action. So, so metta isn't the only thing.
Yeah, it's not the only thing. It's not, metta is not, Dhamma is not about solving any problems. We're not trying to solve problems with Dhamma. We're trying to be able to be with it, to be with difficulty and the problems of our day and age. I read a thing from John Lewis back when he died. He talked about being a freedom rider. Freedom rider. So I get this. So buses were, separated. Black people in the back, white people in the front. And then they passed some law that said you couldn't segregate the Greyhound buses. And so these, I don't even know how they have the courage. These black kids, youth, college level, I think what's his name? John Lewis said they were like, teenagers, college level. They would get on a Greyhound bus at the front of the bus. I don't know if you've ever rode a Greyhound bus before, but Greyhound buses go through very small little towns. And then they would ride the bus from like Arkansas at the bottom all the way up to Chicago. Okay, so you know all the little small towns they're going to be going through, and they're sitting at the front of the bus. Who has the courage to do that? Because I don't have the courage to do it. But somehow or another, if it were not for their courage, I would not be on the front of the bus. So they would get on the bus and they had to take a whole bunch of mess from a lot of people who were angry, who threatened to kick him off in the middle of some strange southern town. I'd be scared to death. And yet, John Lewis talked about how many freedom riders would get on the bus just for the purpose of integrating buses. The thing that I'm pointing to is that what we have lost in the tranquility of the practice itself, you know, the peace that comes with practice, what we have lost is this realization that practice is not about turning everything peaceful. Practice is about being with difficulty without resistance. Can you, whatever that rage or difficulty or upset or I don't like, whatever that is, can you be with it, feel it, and come to an understanding of how to move with it? The metta is to help you do that. The metta practice is a necessary part of practice to help us stay with difficulty so that we don't shrink back from it. And the more you stay with difficulty, the more you begin to understand how much capacity you actually have to respond to difficulty, suffering, and pain. I think the first bus ride, you're probably pretty scared. But once you've done it, then you kind of know how it's going to be. And you take, John Lewis did it. I'm sure many, many kids got beat up and hurt, and some of them may have even been lynched. But John Lewis wasn't. He did it for a long time and he didn't get harmed. So it's sort of like there's a way in which we have to have courage. And courage doesn't come from just wishing things right. Courage comes from learning to work together in community to be with difficulty. And I think we're, as long as we're able to be with the difficulty, I think we'll be able to do whatever needs to be done. What I hear in these three questions is the ordinary mind's fear about the situation. And in Dhamma, the wisdom mind is confident in its ability to respond to the present moment arising. That's what we have to learn to be with. That's why we're practicing, so we can be in the present moment and have the confidence to respond to whatever's present, whether it's non-suffering or suffering. I know this is a lot. It's not, we have to talk about this part of practice in order to know where we're going. We're not just trying to improve ourselves. We're not just trying to somehow or another find some blissful, peaceful state. We are actually trying to practice so we can be in a world that's falling apart and not fall apart with it. That's what we're practicing for. And I think there is no better way to do it than Buddha's awakening mind. So it's time to go. Think on this for the week. Think on this. Don't just think, Tuari, what's the answer? Think on this. What can you, how can this practice support us in this ever-changing, very difficult world we're living in? I'm talking about your meditation practice. How can it really help liberate you to live in this world? It can. And next week, we'll talk about We'll share with each other. How's that possible? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. I don't think there's any announcements, is there? No, good. All right. So I'll see you all next week.